An acid ocean is a terrifying thought, and evidence is mounting that humans may be responsible for tipping a fragile balance at sea, turning science fiction into just plain science. Dr. Burke Hales is a witness. An ocean ecologist at Oregon State University, he also serves on the West Coast Ocean Acidification and Hypoxia Science Panel. Woo! A kind of A-team of researchers. It was convened a couple of years ago to link science and policymaking. Dr. Hales joins us today to share his research and hopefully teach us a thing or two about what's happening in the ocean. Dr. Hales, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. And so for those of us without too much technical knowledge, what is ocean acidification and hypoxia?
There are many, many ways to define this. Ocean acidification is fairly simple. It's the change in ocean carbonate chemistry that comes from rising carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. As carbon dioxide goes up in the atmosphere, it invades into the ocean to a greater degree. The carbon dioxide reacts with the other carbonate system chemicals in the ocean and changes the chemistry. And the most immediate effect that we're seeing in our research and by several others is in the lower favorability for formation of shells of several organisms, oysters and mussels in particular.
So where in the world is this wreaking havoc? The things that make shells, I'm guessing this is shellfish. What kinds of animals are we talking about here that we're seeing this in now?
The research that we've done has been based on mussels and oysters, particularly those that are produced in the commercial shellfish industry in the hatcheries up and down the West Coast. And they're seeing effects, and particularly they're seeing effects in the hatcheries very shortly after the larvae are spawned. And so there's a bottleneck that they need to get through that's very sensitive to this carbonate chemistry.
And those effects, are they die-offs, or what's happening with the farm shellfish due to ocean acidification?
Yeah, ultimately they die. What we're seeing is that in this very, very early stage, you know, within a day or two of fertilization of egg hatch, they have this demand to form their initial shells very, very rapidly, and they're less able to do that as the carbonate chemistry becomes less favorable. And so what we see are deformed shells, smaller shells, and when the conditions get extreme, they actually die off.
So let's take a few steps back here and talk about natural sources of acid in the ocean. How is the pH of the ocean determined naturally, and what's going on differently now?
Well, the pH of the ocean is determined by the carbonate chemistry of the ocean. Mm-hmm. That's one of the things that lots of people don't appreciate coming from outside the ocean chemistry world, like I'm, you know, immersed in, no pun intended, of course. I'll make another joke about how things are very basic.
Please do.
The carbonate chemistry of the ocean is what determines the ocean pH. A lot of times in our undergraduate or high school classes, we hear that pH is a determining factor for all sorts of other things. In the ocean, it's really the other way around. The carbonate chemistry determines the pH. And we're talking about carbonate chemistry. We're talking about things like not just the dissolved carbon dioxide gas, but bicarbonate, which is the primary actor in something like baking soda, and the carbonate, which is what the shell formers really need to make their calcium carbonate shells, and that's the primary actor in say, Tums. If you have an acid stomach, you take a Tums, and the calcium carbonate will neutralize that acidity. And so what happens in the ocean is that there are many, many processes that affect the carbonate chemistry. When phytoplankton grow, they consume CO2, and they lower the CO2 levels in the water, they raise the pH, they raise the carbonate ion concentrations. When they die and decay, they do exactly the opposite. And so what's happening is that the human effect is additive to all that variability. So we have lots of ups and downs in the ocean, but the human effect is moving everything slightly slower down. And so even though there are naturally caused acidic conditions, those naturally caused acidic conditions are now a little worse, a little more frequent, a little more persistent.
So what are the human-caused factors, then, that are perhaps tipping the balance here?
Well, it's the emission of fossil fuels into the atmosphere. So we're putting something like 10 gigatons of carbon into the atmosphere every year as a result of anthropogenic industrial activities, burning gas, heating homes, burning coal, making cement, that sort of thing. And something like 25% of that goes into the ocean every year.
And there's no giant Tums that we can drop in there to neutralize the acidity or somehow undo what we've done?
It's pretty hard to do that. There are people have talked about these environmental engineering bioremediation kinds of things, and it's actually quite difficult to do that. It turns out that the things that people would assume you could do would be, you know, let's say, you know, we mined the White Cliffs of Dover and put all that calcium carbonate into the ocean. The problem is that the ocean actually favors formation of that material, and so it won't just dissolve as we put it into the ocean. The issue is that the organisms that make those shells need it not to be just favorable for formation of the shells, but quite favorable. And so as we make it less favorable, it becomes harder and harder for them to do their biological function.
We're talking with Dr. Burke Hales, an OSU researcher, about ocean acidification here on the Jefferson Exchange. If you want to take part in the conversation, phone number is 800-838-3760. That's 800-838-3760. I'm your guest host today, Emily Curitan, in for Jeffrey Riley. So Dr. Burke Hales, I was doing some research for this interview, and I read a fact, I think it was from Washington State's research team on this topic, and I read that ocean's acidity has increased 10 times faster now than at any time in the last 50 million years. Where do we even get the baseline data to understand how much change has taken place and the rate at which it's taking place?
Yeah, well, so I guess what I would say is that the going back to 50 million years is complicated, and people have done a number of very important studies to verify that, and that work is solid. I guess what I would say is that if it is only the fastest time of increase in the last million years, it's still kind of a big deal. And in the last million years, we know the atmospheric CO2 content in the air very, very well from some excellent work studying ice cores, including by other folks here at Oregon State University. And we know without a doubt that atmospheric CO2 now is significantly higher, about 50% higher now than it was at any time in the last million years. We know that it has risen faster than at any other time in the last million years. And we know that the laws of thermodynamics haven't changed. So higher CO2 in the atmosphere has always meant higher CO2 in the oceans. We just haven't had higher CO2 in the atmosphere in the last, certainly the last million years, and we've certainly never seen it change this fast. The work going back, you know, another 49 million years, again, if we're worried about the distinction between a million years and longer, you know, I think that's sort of irrelevant. But the work going back beyond that has to do with the very long timescales of weathering of the continents and the material that comes into the oceans by rivers and how those rates of inputs change in differing climates and differing tectonic situations.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Burke Hales, OSU oceanographer, let's take a call from Rick in Florence. Rick, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi. Hey, I just have a simple question, I guess it's simple. Ocean acidification and photoplankton or protoplankton, I forget the pronunciation exactly. I heard something maybe 2 years ago that it was causing problems with reproduction and feeding, and I'm just wondering what's going on with it and if there is anything to it. Remember, that's a major producer of oxygen on this planet.
Well, so phytoplankton is what you're talking about, and yes, they produce oxygen and they consume CO2, and they're actually beneficial for reducing the effects of ocean acidification. You know, when you look out there off the coast of Florence, you know, I've been out in the water a few times this summer, and we've had tremendously big blooms. You know, the water just looks brown with all this diatom phytoplankton mass in the water, and they've been drawing the CO2 down to very low levels. The effects of CO2 on plankton, phytoplankton, are a lot less well known. Because they consume CO2, there are some people that think phytoplankton actually like higher CO2. But as far as evidence that higher CO2 causes phytoplankton to have problems with reproduction, I don't think that's there yet. There might be others in the field that would suggest that, but I haven't seen it.
Well, thank you for that question, Rick. Dr. Hales, you serve on a panel with a very fancy-sounding name here, the West Coast Ocean Acidification and Hypoxia Science Panel. Can you tell us a little bit more about what y'all are doing?
Well, so that panel was originally founded by the California Ocean Science Trust, and essentially they're working to figure out how to deal with this problem in ways that us scientists are maybe not that skilled at. You know, they're talking about, you know, if somebody wants to wants to do a policy decision, an emissions decision, an environmental impact statement, that sort of thing, they're trying to figure out how to write that language. And of course, the problem is that this science can be, as I'm sure your listeners are all painfully aware, it can be very detailed. It can be, populated by fancy panels with big multi-syllable names, and the issue is that the policy writers are having a little bit of a hard time keeping up with the science on this because it's so new. And so what this panel has is a team of what they're calling scientific experts or expert advisors, and what we're trying to do is help these folks write policy relevant documents that are consistent with the state of the art of this really rapidly developing science.
And now, not to be too doom and gloom, but the policy writing, are we in time to address something that's affecting the ocean? The biggest thing imaginable, really. What kind of a difference is regional or even national organizing able to make? What kinds of recommendations does your panel make?
I can't tell you because they're still in the works. They're still being put together. And so what they're trying to do is give organizations like, for example, the EPA, the knowledge that they would need to have to say, okay, this is a change in the conditions in Sayula Bay that is actually harmful. And a lot of the old regulations regarding pH and acid-based chemistry are pretty crude. They don't really cover the kinds of changes that we're seeing. They're only going to respond when changes are much, much bigger than we're seeing. And we're already seeing impacts at the levels we're seeing now. So we're trying to help refine that so that they're actually responsive to the changes that are important now. So I guess the first part of your question was, are we in time? And I don't know if I can answer that question, but there's a quote that I read, and I think it was attributed to Mark Twain. Maybe you know this one, but
let's hear it.
Was the best time to plant a tree is 40 years ago. The second best time to plant a tree is today. And so, I think we can't let ourselves be misled by saying, oh, it's too late, we can't do anything. I think 40 years from now, people are going to be, people are going to be happy that we did something as opposed to nothing.
Well, we are talking today with Burke Hales, Dr. Burke Hales, an OSU researcher specializing in ocean chemistry and ocean acidification. You can join the conversation at 800-838-3760 or email jx@jeffnet.org. I'm Emily Curitan, hosting for Jeff Riley today. Dr. Hales, you brought up Suisla Bay. What role do estuaries and freshwater environments play in ocean dynamics?
That's another great question, and everybody should come to Oregon State and enroll in oceanography, and we can spend 4 years teaching you all those things. But the first thing is that obviously all the water that goes into the ocean effectively comes from the rivers, and so all of the chemistry of the rivers and how those are modified by the estuaries on as that water moves from the river through the estuary to the ocean change the inputs to the ocean. But that happens on very, very long timescales. Even though the rivers are the main source of water to the ocean, it would take the rivers something like 40,000 years to replace all the water that's in the ocean. So the oceans are really, really big, and the rivers have a huge impact on them, but it takes very, very long timescales. What's happening right now is that the estuaries themselves are effectively the rearing grounds for these organisms that are sensitive. And estuaries are, just like the ocean, sensitive to atmospheric CO2, and we can measure the chemistry of the estuaries. We can determine how impacted that chemistry is by rising atmospheric CO2, and a lot of these estuaries, particularly on the West Coast, where our rivers are fairly fast residence time. They're not the water, the concept of hard water, that often corresponds to the high alkaline content of the river waters. Our coastal rivers are not very alkaline. They're not very well buffered. And so they're quite sensitive to rising CO2, and these are, in fact, the rearing grounds for things like our native oysters and the introduced commercial Pacific oysters.
And what's the next organism on the food chain to suffer when the oysters and the shellfish are suffering? What's where are we seeing? Is it only in these farmed environments that the changes are being documented?
Well, we have some new work that the shellfish industry in Washington, Oregon has supported, where we've begun a monitoring program in the estuaries, particularly Willapa Bay in Washington, which is where the largest population of nativized or established population of Pacific oysters resides. And those waters are right at the edge of being problematic for these oysters at their spawn levels. Now, there are lots and lots of things going on in any estuary that can contribute to the factors that determine their survival. But what we know is that this is one more factor that's an increased stress on these organisms. You know, if you were to ask me what happens next, you know, who in that category of organisms is most likely to feel the impact next, I'm actually kind of worried about our open coastal mussels. The ones that populate the rocks that support that ecosystem of seabirds and other organisms, I think those are the ones that are sort of next up on the threat list.
Now, is there any dissent in the ocean science community? It seems like you're a pretty connected guy. You're on this panel of 20 esteemed researchers across the whole West Coast studying ocean acidification and hypoxia. Is there any dissent in your community about what's going on and the alarming rate at which it's going on?
Well, so there are, you know, as usual, if you want 12 different answers to one question, ask a scientist. And so this topic, I think, is quite unified within the scientific community, and there are several fundamental pieces of it that are really not up for debate. We absolutely know that atmospheric CO2 is rising. We absolutely know where that extra CO2 is coming from. We absolutely know that it's higher than it's been in the last million years. We absolutely know that it's rising faster than it has in the last million years. We absolutely know that higher CO2 in the atmosphere causes higher CO2 in the ocean. We absolutely know that higher CO2 in the ocean causes lower pH and lower carbonate. So those things are not a matter of debate. What we also absolutely know is that these organisms are sensitive to these changes at the levels we're seeing today. This is not a, you know, problem in 100 years. This is something that matters now. Where the dispute arises, or where the debate arises, is really at the cutting edge of the research. And there's some discussion as to whether or not the natural variability trumps the slow rising baseline, and it doesn't look like that's the case, but there's a handful of scientific folks out there that would suggest that's the case. There's a fair amount of uncertainty about all of these things that change at once. Right now, I told you that as CO2 goes up, pH goes down, carbonate goes down, all of those things might have physiological impact on different organisms. And so, you know, what we've seen is that there's an issue right now right after spawn with larval mussels and oysters, and it's impacting organisms right now today. Now, there might be other things, like Rick brought up, you know, the issues of reproduction and the ability of organisms to smell and to move and to avoid predators, and those are dependent on other features of the carbonate system, the pH, for example, or the PCO2, the CO2 content. And so there's that level of discussion. I would say there's very little debate about whether or not the chemistry is changing and whether or not it's having an impact on organisms.
You mentioned this is such a new science that policymakers are scrambling to keep up with the research on ocean acidification. How long have we known that this is a significant threat or consequence of climate change?
Well, people like to say that Gustav Arrhenius back in 1880 predicted that this would happen.
1880, wow. That's,
yeah,
so a while ago.
Yeah, you know, so as I've been, you know, trying to get across here, the really fundamental pieces of the chemistry and the sources of the CO2 and the amounts of the rise, those have been known for a long, long time. I would say that people had this assumption that, you know, the ocean is big and is well buffered and not very sensitive to these kinds of things, and probably the first revival of concern about that topic came in the mid-'80s. Richard Feely up at the NOAA lab in Seattle wrote one of the early papers in the 80s saying, you know, look, I think we can actually measure the change in the favorability of formation of these calcium carbonate biominerals. And then it really probably, I think, really started accelerating rapidly in the last 5 to 10 years, where we really started to figure out how to pull apart the chemistry and the different impacts of the chemistry on the different physiological processes of the organisms.
And where does support for your research come from?
I get support from the federal agencies, the National Science Foundation and NOAA, and I've gotten some support from the shellfish industry. What happened, the story, and many of your listeners may have heard the Whiskey Creek story, is that when the hatcheries stopped being able to produce spawn, spat, larvae that they send out to the growers in about 2007, they went through a list of remedies to try and remove toxins, to try and remove pathogens, harmful bacteria, and none of these things worked until the hatchery manager, Alan Barton, at Whiskey Creek, reached out to the scientific community, and we started trying to make measurements that would help them understand the water chemistry. And, of course, the problem is that research is expensive, and we don't do things aimed for the mass market. And so what we did in working with Alan was figured out a way to make these measurements, run these samples for him at something like a tenth of the cost of what the traditional research cost would be, so that he could start collecting samples when things were funny.
And was that data useful in turning the situation around?
That did turn the situation around. That solved their problem. They're back up to something like 80 or 90% of historical production with that information.
Well, we've been talking about chemistry, the ocean, and climate change with Dr. Burke Hales, an ocean ecologist at Oregon State University. Thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Hales.
That's my pleasure.